The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Hi, everybody. Wait, let me get up a minute. 1 second. Yeah, I listen to Nicole Sandler. Is it time for the Nicole Sandler show? I forgot to turn the computer on. Let me just walk over here and I'll boot up my computer because I don't want... Oh, crap, never mind, it's okay, I got another one. Leave it there, the cat will get it.
Got a little tune here, a little song to sing for you. That Nicole, she does something. She's really there and does things.
Things. Something. Whatever show, those whatever things may be. Hi! Welcome to a Tuesday, everyone. We are getting ever closer to Thursday night at 8 p.m. All roads lead to Thursday night and the beginning of these hearings we've been waiting for. And waiting and waiting and waiting. And today's show is in preparation for those hearings. Because as you know, you should know by now, my go-to authority on all things surrounding January 6th and the events leading up to that day and the prosecutions of the people who were guilty of attempting to enact a coup on our nation. I get from Marcy Wheeler. Now, there are others who are covering everything, but I'm telling you, Marcy Wheeler is the go-to place. So if you go to emptywheel.net, that's where she does her work. She's got a few other people writing there as well. You should also be following her on Twitter at emptywheel. Now, last week, when we had gotten the word that the Durham investigation, you know, the investigation into the oranges of the Mueller investigation, that what Trump put this guy John Durham in charge as a special prosecutor to do an investigation, and so far I think they brought two cases. The first one did nothing, and the second one was just last week where the jury found Michael Sussman not guilty. Michael Sussman was an attorney for Hillary Clinton during the 2016 campaign, and they alleged that he lied to the FBI, and the jury said, no, he didn't. Done. They deliberated for 6 hours. It was over. Boom. Done. This Durham sham. See, here's the thing. When I talk about opposite world, I really mean it. You know, they're the ones who talk about it's fake news, it's a fake investigation, it's a hoax. Well, the Durham thing was a hoax. Trump, or Dump, as I've called him for years, and somebody finally picked up on it. Dump, you know, he's the guy who, he talks about fake news when he's the one perpetrating it, right? He talks about this is a hoax. When he's the hoax, he's now saying in his latest Nuremberg rally, he said that the whole 1-6 insurrection was a hoax. So, in other words, he's saying, who are you going to believe, me or your lying eyes? Believe your eyes. Don't believe him. So anyway, so last week when the news broke that the Durham investigation produced this turkey, after 3 years, that's all they could come up with, a nothing case against Michael Sussman that was decided by a jury in 6 hours who said, there's no there there. Just stop it. Go away. And they need to dissolve that special prosecutor's office because it's nonsense. But see, this is what they do. Do you remember Benghazi? I mean, how can you forget? If you put in Benghazi Tourette's in the search box at NicoleSandler.com, you'll probably come up with a lot of shows because that's what they did. They had hearings ad nauseum on Benghazi, which was a tragedy, but it wasn't a scandal. But they didn't have a scandal to prosecute during Obama's term, so they tried to turn that into one because they're all about making shit up. That's what they do. And it's not just, it's the politicians, it's their media echo chamber.
your original source for fake news. Fox News. We make shit up.
They do. And now we know they're not even going to run the hearings. Every other channel will. All the cable news, well, the actual news stations will. Fox is not news. So I guess that explains it. They're going to run it on the business channel, which nobody knows where it is because nobody watches it. So that's, they're going to run that over there, and they're going to keep their regular programming because God forbid you miss Tucker Carlson. Oh, my God. And I'm laughing. But more people watch that crap than any other real news source. None of it makes sense. Anyway, so last week when the news broke, thank you, Michael Belzano, who made a nice donation on in the super chat on YouTube. Always appreciated, like truly appreciated. So anyway, as I was saying, last week when the news broke that the Durham investigation spit out a case and that, you know, the jury found him not guilty in 6 hours and it's over. I called on Marcy Wheeler because she's my go-to person. And as is the case, whenever I talk to Marcy these days, I just strap in for about an hour and let her go. And so I ran it. So that week, it was last Tuesday when this happened, a week ago today. Oh, no, I'm sorry. It was a week ago tomorrow. I get the days mixed up. So it was a week ago tomorrow at when the news broke. And my show was booked up for the rest of the week. But that night, I was filling in for Brad Friedman, guest hosting the broadcast. So, you know, I always give Brad my, you know, week-old, day-old interview goods. So this time we switched it. So he had it for a week. I posted it up at the Brad blog. And now today I'm going to share it with you and tell you that the only thing that has changed in the ensuing 6 days was two things, two more shoes dropped. And boy, they're dropping everywhere these days. First, Peter Navarro, the former guy's former trade advisor, which cut everything about every appointment he made, every advisor he brought in was just more, you know, questionable than the next. Peter Navarro, what a creep. I mean, he is a creepy man. Listen to him. He's just a creep. Anyway, so Peter Navarro was arrested. To refresh your memory, Peter Navarro had been subpoenaed by the 1-6 committee for two things. One, to appear to give testimony, and two, to hand over certain documents. And each of those had a date by which he was to appear or turn over the documents. He did neither. He refused to comply. Guess what that does, or what it should do, is put out a warrant for your arrest. And that's exactly what happened. Problem is, and again, I forgot to pull this clip to share with you. I wonder if I have it. It might be right here at my fingertips, but it might not. Let's see if this is it. I think it is. Here we go.
Instead of coming.
So Peter Navarro, it bitches. So he was getting on a plane to go somewhere. I think Nashville or something. Who knows? Wherever. He was getting on a plane leaving D.C. when the FBI, the authorities went and arrested him. Pulled him. I don't know if they pulled him off the plane or got him before he went on the plane. And poor baby. He was all roughed up.
Instead of coming to my door where I live, which, by the way, is right next to the FBI.
Yeah.
Instead of calling me and say, hey, we need you down at court. We've got a warrant for you. I would have gladly come. What did they do?
You would gladly come? Why would they ever think that? You didn't show up the day you were supposed to testify. You didn't turn over the documents that were subpoenaed on the day they were supposed to be there or afterwards. They should now give you a heads up to say, hey, you screwed us over twice, but now we're telling you we're coming to arrest you. That's not how it works, Navarro, moron.
Dude, They intercepted me getting on the plane.
Good.
And then they put me in handcuffs. They bring me here. They put me in leg irons. They stick me in a cell. By the way,
that's
historical note.
That's what happens when you break the law. So that's the first thing that's different since I taped this with Marcy. So we will not be talking about Peter Navarro's arrest, nor will we be talking about the extra charges added to Enrique Tarrio, the current former whatever head of the Proud Boys, once and future king. I don't know. He was or is a leader of the Proud Boys. He and four other Proud Boys leaders who had already been charged with. Hold on. Let me see if I can find what the charges were. I do have them written in my description today. They were already charged with, with conspiracy and obstruction of an official proceeding. Those were the charges that they had been indicted on. Well, there was another indictment for Enrique and his Proud Boys. They are now charged with seditious conspiracy. That's, you know, sedition. Yeah, that is them coming out and saying it. They were planning and plotting to overturn the results of a free and fair election. So those two, I need to go because now we're going to be late. I've been talking for way too long. So anyway, those happened since I taped this with Marcy Wheeler. Everything else remains the same. So as we like to do around these parts, when we're talking about things surrounding January 6th, we call on the expert. In this case, we go to Ireland. At times like this, we need to call on Marcy Wheeler. Checking in with Marcy in Ireland first to have to ask, how are things over there?
The weather's been really beautiful here. So that's all we talk about here normally. And it's been sunny and generally not rainy and sunny. So it's been great.
Good. Over here, it's been oppressively hot. So
yeah, it's rarely anything approximating hot here. So
really? Oh, boy, you're getting, a lot of people are looking for places to move to. So Ireland, I guess you recommend it?
Maybe.
You don't want too many of us coming over there, I'm guessing.
No.
Okay.
And it's not going to work for some people, so.
I hear you. Oh, yeah. Some of us are stuck. So anyway, so, if you listen to right-wing media.
There's your first mistake.
Yeah, I know. Well, I don't. But I said, if you do, you'd been waiting for something from the Durham investigation. Yesterday, we got an outcome for the first and only case brought to trial by this Durham probe after 3 years of looking. So if you don't mind, can we start from the beginning and explain what John Durham was looking into?
Well, a really important point, and I'm going to write this up in the next couple of days, is that there was no predication. There was no dead body. There was no stolen emails. There was no advanced knowledge of a hack and leak campaign. This investigation started because Bill Barr, even before he returned as attorney general, just had a feeling there was something wrong with the predication of the Russian investigation. And so if you read his memoir, which I've done, don't do that either.
No, I won't.
But if you read his memoir, he makes it very clear. He's like, okay, shut down Mueller. Now I have to get Durham started on this investigation of how it all started. He doesn't describe anything more than kind of gut feel that there was something wrong with it. So there's no predication behind this investigation. Barr in the last couple of days was on some right-wing media show, and he admitted that even though there was an ongoing DOJ-IG investigation at the time by Michael Horowitz into Carter Page's targeting under FISA, he nevertheless started Durham off. And he described, well, you know, we sort of killed time until such time as we could get a grand jury. And they got a grand jury via this prosecution handed to Durham on a silver platter, basically. This guy named Kevin Kleinsmith pled guilty to altering a document. And it was serious. I mean, I think that it was right that he be prosecuted, but there was no reason it needed a special prosecutor to be prosecuted. What Barr did is use that investigation to get a grand jury and start unpacking everybody's lives. And by everybody, I mean all the FBI people who were involved, everyone at Fusion, everyone in the Alpha Bank case, which we're going to get to. All these researchers who found an anomaly and said this could be dangerous, this could be serious, their lives have all been exposed, and not just exposed, but their research has been exposed to Russia. So that's how this investigation started. And then last year, 2021, on the very last day before this, or 2 days, 3 days, this before the statute of limitations expired, on a meeting that Michael Sussman had with FBI General Counsel Jim Baker, Durham charged him with lying, Michael Sussman, lying to Jim Baker, the FBI's General Counsel.
Now, Michael Sussman was Hillary Clinton's lawyer at the time?
Yeah, so he worked at Perkins Coie, and he was through much of 2016, he was the point person between the FBI and all of the Democrats who were getting hacked. And so here's this guy who spent 2016 trying to prevent serial nation state hacks, and he's the guy being prosecuted, not, say, Paul Manafort, mm-hmm. who was trading information, not Donald Trump, who was asking for more hacks,
right.
Not Roger Stone, who was in advanced contact with the people who were releasing the documents. Michael Sussman's the one who gets charged. And even from the beginning, it was clear this case was weak because there was only one witness, Jim Baker. There were no notes. There were no contemporaneous notes. There were hearsay notes of Baker sharing the allegations after the fact. And then from there, the case got worse and worse because it became clear that Durham had not done basic investigative things before charging Michael Sussman. For example, he had never subpoenaed Jim Baker, the FBI general counsel.
Wow.
And right. And in March of this year, probably because Michael Sussman kept saying, I mean, so Michael Sussman in 2017 testified to Congress under oath, and he said, the reason I went to the FBI is because we were about to release this story about basically that there were weird communications between Trump Organization and Alpha Bank and Trump Organization and Spectrum Health, which is a hospital in Grand Rapids, Michigan, where I used to live.
Right.
And the story Sussman told at the trial was that they had gotten the New York Times to run with the story. It was going to be a great story, putting Trump on his heels. And then on September 18th, Sidney Blumenthal is involved in every politicized trial in D.C., and this one didn't fail on that regards.
Right.
Right before the story is about to go, Sidney Blumenthal sent Robbie Mook his intelligence about how panicked Trump was because he knew there was going to be a New York Times story about his ties to Russia. And so seemingly in response to knowing that Trump was going to blow a gasket, Sussman said, I'm going to go to the FBI and give them a heads up because I want them to have the option of maybe asking the New York Times to hold the story. So he went, he sent Jim Baker a text on the 18th saying, hey, I've got something sensitive and time sensitive. I'm not doing this on behalf of any client. I'm doing this to help the FBI. Comes in the next day, tells him that the New York Times, he doesn't say the New York Times, he says some outlet is about to break the story, wanted to give you a heads up. And within days, the FBI is like, you know, we'd really like to investigate this before the New York Times reports on it. And so they go back to Sussman and say, can you tell us who's about to publish this story? And Sussman consults with a guy named Rodney Jaffe, who's one of the researchers who found these anomalies. And they decide that they're going to share Eric Lichtblau's name with the FBI. The FBI kills the story. And then the outcome of this story becomes worse and worse, both for the Democrats and for Eric Lichtblau. So it was the stupidest thing that Michael Sussman could have done, to go to the FBI. And that's, in fact, what Mark Elias, the Democrats' chief lawyer,
right,
and Robbie Mook, who was the campaign manager, that's what they both said on the stand. They both were like, the FBI, going to the FBI is the most obvious way to kill this story. And uh-huh. Oh, by the way, we didn't trust the FBI because Jim Comey was stomping all over our campaign. And so in spite of the fact that it didn't make any sense, Durham decided to charge this. As I said, he never subpoenaed Jim Baker. And it appears that he only found that text I told you about, the September 18th text saying, I want to help the FBI. After Sussman kept saying, look, I know there's evidence that we cooperated with the FBI to kill the story. Keep looking. And Durham never found it. He kept looking. And then finally, like almost 6 months after he charged Sussman, he's like, say, Jim Baker, would you mind looking into your iCloud account to see if there's anything pertaining to Sussman? Just Sussman, by the way, not the other subjects of the investigation. Right. And that's when Durham's case started to fall further and further apart, because that text actually hurt his case, bizarrely. He then subsequently found materials that were at DOJIG, which made it clear that by March of 2017, the FBI knew that Sussman had a client. So the whole thing just fell apart. And it fell apart because John Durham didn't bother to test the explanation for the meeting that Michael Sussman gave under oath to Congress. Never bothered to test it. And guess what? Michael Sussman was telling the truth to Congress, told, you know, there's no evidence he lied to the FBI. And so yesterday, after the jury acquitted Michael Sussman, they were like, this was a waste of our time. There are better things that DOJ should be doing.
So this investigation, as it were, has been going on for over 3 years. This is the only case Durham's whole investigation brought, and it was a nonsense case. But this is what...
It's not actually the only one. There's still one outstanding against a guy named Igor Danchenko, who was Christopher Steele's primary subsource for the dossier.
Uh-huh.
Same kind of thing, though. He is accused of lying to the FBI when he was very cooperatively telling the FBI what he had actually told Christopher Steele, which was different from what Christopher Steele included in his reports. And for cooperating with the FBI, Durham decided to charge him too. In some ways, it's an even more problematic case. In a lot of ways, it's an even more problematic case. I mean, that case, the Danchenko case, Durham couldn't even competently cut and paste from his own materials. Like, if you compare what communications he's actually relying on and what he's charged, they don't match.
Right.
You know, that shouldn't have been approved. But anyway,
okay.
So that one's due to go to trial in October if he can declassify all the information that he needs to share with Igor Danchenko, which he has been having problems doing.
But there seems to be a huge disconnect for me again, I haven't paid much attention to the Durham story over the last 3 years because there, from what I could tell, there's not much of a story. Although right-wing media, again, has played it up. But if you listen to the, you know, how they were putting all their hopes on this.
I told you not to listen to that.
I know, I don't. But check this out. This is just a 15-second clip.
I look forward to Bull Durham's report. That's the one I look forward to.
Okay.
You know, what happened to Durham? Where's Durham?
And by the way, where's Durham? What happened? Where is he? He disappeared.
What did they expect out of Durham? They expected Durham to validate Trump's big lie?
Well, this is of a piece of, it's equivalent to Trump trying to trump up an investigation of Hunter Biden, right? Trump, like Russian-tied oligarchs across the world, like to use a justice system to retaliate against their rivals. Trump did this in 2016, but her emails, right?
Right.
Like, Trump's entire 2016 campaign was built around criminalizing Hillary Clinton for things that were nowhere near as bad as he was doing in real time. So this is a piece. Like, he believed that he could trump up an investigation against the people who were mean to him. And oh, by the way, this has had the result of doing real damage to the FBI, to these researchers. These are cybersecurity researchers. They've been involved in helping the FBI hunt down and prevent hacks, especially from Russia, for years. And these people have all been compromised, have all been badly hurt by this investigation. And I think, you know, it's hard to tell whether Trump believed that. It's hard to tell what Trump believed. It's still to this day hard to believe what Durham's prosecutors believed, because they engaged in such bad faith that it's hard to tell whether they're just corrupt or whether they were embarrassed by the exposure of their incompetence and so tried to brave through the prosecution, thinking maybe they could convince the jury to convict in any case, or whether they just knew that their goal, or, you know, I mean, one of the things they did, let me give you an example, is that I wrote a post about how these prosecutors broke 7 rules that Judge Christopher Cooper, the judge in the case, that he set. One of the rules had to do with this Hillary Clinton tweet. After not the New York Times, but Slate wrote a story about this Alpha Bank anomaly, the campaign released a tweet under Hillary's name saying, wow, this is really bad. Maybe the FBI should investigate. And Judge Cooper kind of went back and forth about whether this tweet should come in. It was clearly hearsay. It was clearly going to distract the jury. And right before, like, as prosecutors were questioning Robbie Mook, the prosecutor takes a break and says, Judge, can I introduce this tweet? And the judge is like, well, okay, but do not read from the tweet and do not read the language from the tweet that references the FBI. And so the prosecutor hands an unredacted tweet to Robbie Mook and orders him to read. Wasn't supposed to read from orders and doesn't stop him. No one stops him until after the FBI stuff comes out. The media went nuts, right? But that was the single biggest story that came out of this prosecution, and predictably.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, you know, what Trump and Barr are using to say that Hillary Clinton should be prosecuted. And legally, because the judge tried to put the horse back in the barn after he had let it go, legally, that evidence was not sent back with the jury to deliberate over when they started deliberating on Friday. But that was the big takeaway from this case. And there were many cases of this where Durham created not a legal case, but a media case. And, you know, the media fell for it every single time. And so that taking away from that, one is led to believe that Durham doesn't care whether he gets prosecutions. He cares, like Trump was looking for in the announcement from Ukraine that they were investigating Hunter Biden. It's not the investigation, it's the announcement of this, you know, conspiracy theory that John Durham has been claiming that matters. And I really do think that's what Durham has been focused on since he indicted Sussman. And we'll see whether he is reined in with Danchenko.
Okay, see, the whole thing to me, it is crazy. I mean, it sounds like that it's all based on an alleged lie told by Sussman to the FBI. So the Republicans are going nuts because they alleged that there was a lie. Can we look back on Donald Trump's entire administration and how many times he lied? I mean, they're really going nuts over an alleged lie.
But remember, the point to this is the point is to claim that the investigation into Donald Trump, the Russian investigation, this was Bill Barr's intent from the beginning.
Okay.
This is what Bill Barr, the Attorney General of the United States, chose to use DOJ for. It was to discredit the Russian investigation, which led to the conviction of Donald Trump's National Security Advisor for lying to cover up his ties to Russia. It led to the prosecution of Trump's foreign affairs advisor, the coffee boy, for lying to cover up his ties to Russia. It led to the prosecution of Trump's personal lawyer, Michael Cohen, mm-hmm. for lying to cover up his ties to Russia. It led to the prosecution of Roger Stone for lying to cover up his ties to Russia. It led to a judgment by Judge Amy Berman Jackson that Paul Manafort was lying to cover up his ties to Russia. So that's what the Russian investigation came up with, which was that everyone in Trump's orbit was lying to cover up what really went on with Russia.
Right.
Barr dreamt up this investigation, and the goal is to provide some other basis rather than Trump got advance notice. And it wasn't just the coffee boy. There's very good reason to believe that Roger Stone had advance notice and was in continued contact with GRU persona, Guccifer 2.0, that Trump had multiple strands of advance notice of this hack and leak campaign targeting his competitor in 2016, and Barr is trying to invent a different story. And so the goal behind this investigation was to falsely suggest that when Michael Sussman came to the FBI over a month and a half after the investigation into Trump had started and said, there's this weird anomaly, maybe you can look into it, that was the beginning of the investigation into Trump and not, in fact, a tip from Australia saying, you know, your coffee boy knew about the hack and leak campaign before anyone else did.
Right.
And so that's the goal. That's the goal, is to discredit the Russian investigation, to claim that that the investigation into Trump wasn't meritorious. I run into trolls every single hour on Twitter who claim to me that Durham has had much bigger outcomes than Mueller did, which is nonsense.
Right.
You know, like people, right. you know, like they're telling me, well, you know, Mueller never had to bring a case to trial. Well, I mean, he brought the Manafort case to trial and DC U.S. attorney brought the Stone case to trial. Well, Mueller didn't get any prosecutions. Mueller got 30 something, you know, Mueller, I just laid through the right. five people who were prosecuted or found to have lied in Russian hack and leak related right. crimes right. and then throw in Paul Manafort's money laundering and yada, yada, yada.
Right. 34 indictments, guilty pleas, a lot of stuff. And here's the other disconnect. So, you know, you say you run across them on Twitter all the time. Well, I run across them in my travels. In fact, last week I had an interview with a guy, a journalist who writes for The Nation, who believes that Russia did not interfere in the 2016 election, that, you know, there's this, they're buying the right wing narrative about this when the Mueller investigation.
Look, let's be clear. It's not a right wing narrative. It's a Russian narrative.
It's a Russian narrative that they've yeah. picked. OK, that for some reason, not only Fox and that whole part of our media goes along with, but some self-proclaimed progressives do as well. And like this reporter for The Nation, he said the only thing that Russia was guilty of was buying some ads on Facebook. It's like, what, have we not been reading the same thing? Didn't the Mueller report really lay it out, although Barr mischaracterized what it found, and that's what they've run with?
Yeah. And interestingly, and this is a fact that literally I'm the only one to have reported, the Mueller investigation actually, everyone's like, well, he found no collusion, no conspiracy. He wasn't looking for collusion. Collusion's not a crime. He didn't charge conspiracy.
Right.
Because while there was abundant evidence of a conspiracy, there wasn't enough to prove beyond reasonable doubt. That's a really interesting judgment, because Durham treated this Alpha Bank thing as a conspiracy. He actually argued that to Judge Cooper. He said, we want all of these extra files to come in. It's a joint venture, just like a conspiracy, even though it's not a crime. So Durham was given great leeway by the judge to argue that this was a conspiracy, arguably far too much. And even given that leeway, he still failed to get a guilty conviction. Wow. Whereas I think Mueller could have easily gotten a guilty conviction with Manafort. My suspicion is that they didn't want to charge at that point, and they believed you know, either Manafort was going to be pardoned or he was going to be in jail for 7 years, given his money laundering convictions. Same with Roger Stone, both ended up being pardoned. And so I think that one of the things DOJ or Mueller was doing was buying time for these, not just for the criminal investigations to go forward, but for counterintelligence investigations to understand how Russia was working. But the important thing is that, Barr claimed that this was a final conclusion, no conspiracy, right? The actual conclusion, for the most part, was lots of evidence of conspiracy, not enough to charge. But what's interesting is there is a footnote in the Mueller report that was not declassified until literally the night before the 2020 election.
Okay.
That said, we haven't charged Stone in a hacking conspiracy with Russia because we still have outstanding questions. And we have referred those questions, multiple, to DC U.S. Attorney's Office. So in other words, when Mueller finished up in March of 2019, they were still investigating Roger Stone in a hacking conspiracy with Russia.
Wow.
And they used his prosecution to advance that investigation, to get people to testify without them believing that they were testifying. So in other words, that investigation went through at least April 2020 when Bill Barr killed the Roger Stone prosecution. And ultimately, the facts show that Bill Barr halted an ongoing investigation into whether Roger Stone conspired with Russia. It was not a conclusion. It was still ongoing when Barr took over, and by all appearances, he killed that investigation into Roger Stone.
All right. Now I'm going to segue a little bit, because there are news reports out this week that all of a sudden the DOJ is ramping up its investigation and prosecutions. You've been saying all along that Merrick Garland is working on this. Give him time, give him space, let him do it. Are we at that point?
It's not ramping up, Nicole. It's what I've been telling you all along. Let me give you an example. Okay. One of the key details is that Peter Navarro revealed he had been subpoenaed back. He received a subpoena. Peter Navarro, remember, was a financial advisor to Trump who was part of Steve Bannon's plan to discredit the election. And he wrote a book claiming that the plan was just to get members of Congress to discredit the election, not to start a riot. He claims the riot was not what he intended.
Right.
And the January 6th committee subpoenaed him, like they subpoenaed Bannon.
Right.
And both men refused to cooperate. In Bannon's case, it was ridiculous because he was claiming executive privilege, but he wasn't a member of the administration. In Navarro's case, he was claiming executive privilege, which he had more basis for, except he had written a book.
Right.
So how can you say this is privilege when you wrote a book?
Mm-hmm.
So in both cases, they were fairly egregious cases of them blowing off the committee. Committee refers both. So recently, just in the last couple of weeks, and in fact, you can see the prosecutor who dropped off a case against Anthony Gionne, otherwise known as Baked Alaska. She dropped off his case maybe 2 weeks ago, and in the subsequent 2 weeks, subpoenaed Peter Navarro and asked him basically for everything that he would have given to the January 6th committee. And it's a real subpoena, you know, it's not like now DOJ is going to come after him. And this is one of the bases that everyone's saying, oh, lots of progress. And the reason this is not new is because DOJ did very similar things with Steve Bannon when he was referred for contempt to DOJ back in November. And what they did in November was subpoena the call records for the attorney he shares with Rudy Giuliani.
Okay.
And they got those call and email records, not the content, but who have you been contacting? They got those materials going back to March 3rd of 2021. So well before Bannon was subpoenaed by the committee and well before the committee even existed, they wanted the communications between Bannon's lawyer, the one he shares with Rudy Giuliani, and Trump's people. And so this investigation into basically the cover-up of January 6th has been ongoing at least since November. Navarro is just complaining about it. So the people who only believe there's investigation if there's a squawking Trump person now believe there's investigation. But if there is so much continuity between all of these things, yes, it takes time. Yes, you build on the existing investigation. Yes, DOJ is piggybacking on the January 6th committee investigation. But it's been clear that they were going to do that since at least July as well. One of the things they've done, DOJ has done, is the January 6th committee has gotten a ton of information from Trump.
Yeah.
And the process they've used to get that information from Trump is they tell the archives what they want. Biden looks at the request and says, I'm going to waive privilege. Mm-hmm. This is not a criminal investigation. So right. Biden says, is there a good basis for a co-equal branch of government to be able to get these records for an investigation into attack on them? Basically, Biden approves it. Trump gets a little leeway to squawk, but generally not. And then if the archives believes that these materials are relevant, they get handed over to the January 6th committee. Guess what's happened? You know, like, guess what happens once that's done? DOJ can then subpoena those materials,
right,
from the archives and have an executive privilege review already done that doesn't require Joe Biden to waive executive privilege for a criminal investigation. So what they've done, and this was actually a problem that Mueller had, was, you know, Trump waived executive privilege for the investigation, but not for prosecution. And that proved to be a problem even with the Mueller report. DOJ, learning how Trump works, has used the January 6th committee, among other ways, to get executive privilege reviews without telling Biden anything about the criminal investigation. So one should assume that all the materials that are being shared with the January 6th committee are also being shared with the DOJ investigation. But again, without Biden knowing about it and without Trump actually thinking about it.
Wow. In fact, didn't the DOJ ask the January 6th committee for, I guess, all of the interviews that they've done? And January 6th committee is saying, well, hold on, we need to do our thing first.
And January 6th committee is right to do that. And they're probably having a discussion about specific transcripts right mm-hmm. now. Just as one example, when Ali Alexander went in to testify, I think he testified for six or seven hours. He, remember, was the organizer for Stop the Steal. He's yep. got he's a mentee of Roger Stone. He spent the day with Alex Jones. Alex Jones brought all the bodies from the Ellipse to the Capitol. So he was there with Alex Jones, Pied Piper of the insurrection.
Right.
And Ali Alexander, before he testified to the January 6th committee, said, here's what I'm going to say. This is what they do. These criminals always say, here's what I'm going to testify to so they can compare stories. And this was a replay of what Roger Stone did with HPSI in 2017 with the Russian investigation. Didn't work then. He was prosecuted. Nevertheless, Ali Alexander signed up to do the same dumb thing that Roger Stone had done, involving one of the same lawyers that Roger Stone had used. And the story he said that he was going to tell is a story that Owen Schroyer, who is basically, you apparently listen to way too much right-wing media. Schroyer is basically Alex Jones Jr.
Oh, okay.
And Owen Schroyer was arrested in August in this investigation, basically because he had special prohibition against being a loud jerk at the Capitol. Do you like how I didn't say a bad word there?
I do. I appreciate it.
And so he ended up being a loud jerk on January 6th, and that was a crime especially for him. So he was arrested. He's being prosecuted. And the same story that Ali Alexander told in, I think, December to the January 6th committee, Schroyer started telling before that to DOJ. And a Trump-appointed judge, Tim Kelly, already heard that story and said, nah, no, that's wrong. That doesn't make any sense. Wow. And so Ali Alexander told that story. now he's stuck telling that story. And there's very good reason to believe that DOJ has some communications with Ali Alexander, with some of the other people involved, because they got them way back in January, March of 2021. I mean, these are the steps that DOJ took a long time ago that are coming to fruition as they're moving towards people like Ali Alexander. And so we should believe that Ali Alexander's story is not consistent with the facts that are in DOJ's possession, and that DOJ knows that. And so that's a transcript that I suspect that they would like to have.
Oh, without a doubt. Marcy Wheeler is with us. She's been covering this story like nobody else at emptywheel.net. It should be part of your daily reading if it isn't already. So next week, the public hearings begin. We've been waiting for a long time for this. Do you have any ideas about what we're going to see? I mean, they haven't released the witness list yet. I believe there's only two nights of prime time at the bookending the week, I guess, of testimony. I think it's just 6 days of testimony. And during in the middle, it'll all be during daytime hours. But that's about all I know. Do you know any more?
Do I know any more? I can intuit more, which is that one of the big storylines that you're going to come out with, is that Trump did absolutely nothing to stop an attack on the Capitol.
Mm-hmm.
That he cheered as his vice president was being targeted,
mm-hmm.
and that he set up his vice president to be targeted. So the storyline I expect that the January 6th committee will tell is that Trump riled up a mob with his false claims about election theft. He brought them to D.C. He riled them up to assault the Capitol with his speech on January 6th. And then once they started assaulting the Capitol, and this was all done to pressure Mike Pence to basically overturn democracy.
Right.
And when Mike Pence refused to overturn democracy, Trump basically threatened him with assassination. He right. used the mob to threaten him with assassination, did nothing to stop it, did nothing to stop the attack on the Capitol, and cheered the violence targeting Mike Pence. And you'll have videos of the testimony from Trump's own children making that clear,
right.
making it clear that they begged him to try and intervene, and they refused, first the Phil son and then even Ivanka. So that's the story you're going to hear. And that story is basically going to lay out what the lawsuit against Trump, the Benny Thompson lawsuit against Trump lays out, which is that Trump conspired with at least the militias
mm-hmm.
to attack the Capitol. And wow. you're going to find, and while that's happening, Nicole, is you're going to have these cases, the cases against the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers continue to advance. And in those cases, you're going to learn more about the advanced planning that the Proud Boys used, how they riled up the mob, how they kind of managed the mob to maximal effect. DOJ is going to show.
Uh-huh.
I'm not sure how much of this the January 6th commission will show, but ultimately those two investigations are going to talk about how there was actual coordination secondhand, thirdhand, not Trump. As far as we know,
right.
Trump did not speak directly with Oath Keeper head Stuart Rhodes, although Rhodes tried to talk to Trump after the January 6th insurrection. As far as we know, Trump did not speak directly to Enrique Tarrio, but he is even better connected with people one degree away from Trump than Stuart Rhodes is, and Rhodes is very well connected. But through a network of people, there was genuine coordination going on the attack on the Capitol. And once the attack on the Capitol started, Trump cheered it on and did nothing to stop it.
Right. And so the January 6th committee is going to lay this out in that series of hearings, public hearings, televised beginning next week. And then the Justice Department can use that testimony in whatever case they do, or do we not right. know? Yeah, they can.
No, they can. I mean, and this is, again, a point I make. Everyone's like, wow, you know, how brilliant DOJ is asking for help from the January 6th committee.
Well, what are they supposed to do? Why repeat right. the work?
But they did this. I mean, Mueller did the same thing. People forget this, that Mueller used false statements, referrals from both the CISI, the Senate Intelligence Committee, and the House Intelligence Committee, mm-hmm. used referrals to advance his own investigation. Just as one example, and this is one that people often forget, there was a guy named Sam Patton, and he was sort of the mirror image of Paul Manafort. He was he had a partnership with Konstantin Kilimnik that was independent of Paul Manafort's partnership with Konstantin Kilimnik. Konstantin Kilimnik, of course, the government is pretty explicit, is a Russian spy. Mm-hmm. So these two men had ties to this Russian spy. Sam Patton actually worked on Cambridge Analytica with Konstantin Kilimnik. And Sam Patton, to the Senate Intelligence Committee in early 2018, lied about being a straw donor for inauguration tickets for one of the Ukrainians that he had been working with.
Okay.
So in other words, he told Sissy, you know, no, I didn't buy these tickets for this Russian-backed Ukrainian oligarch. They referred that as a false statement to Mueller in early 2018. And then the FBI shows up to Patton's house, and Patton tries to delete some evidence. And by then in May of 2018, Mueller starts talking to Patton. And by that point, they have not only that false statement laid out, but also a FARA violation, meaning he should have registered his ties to Kilimnik and the efforts he was making in the U.S. with Kilimnik and did not. And so they flipped him. And this was all, I think Kilimnik knew this and probably some other people knew this in real time, but it wasn't public until August when he pled guilty. But basically, Mueller got May to August, so 3 months of cooperation from Patton to understand how Konstantin Kilimnik worked while he was still working on, hopefully, and this failed, but getting Paul Manafort to flip. So it was really valuable information about how the Russians and Ukrainians were interfering in U.S. efforts and how Konstantin Kilimnik worked. He actually, Sam Patton, provided some of the most important testimony about this famous August 2, 2016 meeting between Manafort and Kilimnik, because Kilimnik went to Patton afterward and said, I know how Trump is going to win the election. You know, that's your second witness. Wow. Against that meeting. And again, Mueller would never have gotten that had Sissy not quietly referred Patton for a false statement investigation. And the prosecution of Stone, and remember, I explained earlier that the actual prosecution that everyone watched was just a step in a larger prosecution into whether he was conspiring with Russia. You know, they were like, we're going to focus on WikiLeaks, mm-hmm. because that's what's public. And meanwhile, we're going to investigate a larger, much more sensitive investigation into Roger Stone's direct ties to the Russians. And they used Stone's HPSI testimony much in the way that they might use, say, Ali Alexander's testimony to the January 6th committee. They used his testimony as a tool in the larger prosecution of Stone. I suspect that they are doing the same thing with the referrals, the contempt referrals of people like Bannon and
Mark Meadows. What about Mark Meadows?
Yeah, Mark Meadows is a special case. Okay. Navarro is the one I was thinking of.
Gotcha. Right.
For a second. But you know, everyone's complaining that DOJ is not acting on these contempt referrals quickly enough. And one thing that I keep repeating and people keep ignoring is that the Bannon case was assigned to Carl Nichols, who is not just a Trump appointee, but he's a Clarence Thomas clerk. And he's roiling up the DOJ investigation in another way, which is neither here nor there. But and he, in one of the early hearings in the Bannon case, said, you only take criminal contempt against somebody if you've given up hope of them cooperating. This is not about coercing their cooperation, which is what civil contempt is for. This is about punishing somebody for not cooperating. And once you assume that, and one should assume that Navarro would be handed to the same judge, that Meadows would be handed to the same judge, then the advantages of prosecuting somebody go down if you think that they would be more useful as cooperators. And oh, by the way, that a prosecutor I told you about who had been prosecuting Baked Alaska.
Yeah.
Who's the one who sent the subpoena to Peter Navarro. Every case that she was involved with in the January 6th investigation involved somebody who flipped.
Oh.
And in one case, people that they're trying to flip a second level. So she seems to have a particular focus, a particular skill set on getting cooperating witnesses. She's the one who subpoenaed Peter Navarro. And you have to ask yourself, I mean, with Meadows, again, he's a separate case because he's got a whole lot of criminal liability that Navarro may not have.
Right.
But with all of these people, would you rather flip them? Or would you rather them serve a month in jail?
Right. No, we want to flip them. That makes more sense. So we get useful information out of them, and a month isn't going to do anything.
Right. So that's what I think is going on. And I think that DOJ is using these criminal referrals as a way to say, okay, you're covering up something. Let's go investigate what you're covering up. And then once we've shown that you... okay, now that you asked about Meadows, let me go to Meadows.
Okay.
Meadows, there's that report recently that he is known to have burned documents in his White House fireplace.
Right.
Meadows replaced his phone. He was doing a lot of White House business on his personal phone and on his personal email account. He did not at first send those documents to the archives to be archived. After such time as he had to have known there was a grand jury investigation, he replaced his phone, thereby destroying evidence that would have been covered by the Presidential Records Act. Mm-hmm. So even ignoring everything else Mark Meadows did, he starts off with a whole bunch of evidence that he obstructed this investigation, criminally obstructed this investigation. So that's the baseline for Meadows. And my suspicion is that at the very least he'll be charged with obstruction and they'll try and flip him that way. But then add to that, because all of these investigations are ultimately going to A or multiple interlocking conspiracy cases, go to that Mark Meadows was involved in setting up Trump's call to Brad Raffensperger in Atlanta.
Okay.
Mark Meadows was involved in setting up the fake elector scheme involving seven swing states.
Ooh.
Mark Meadows was involved in getting and working with members of Congress who kind of cheered the insurrection as it happened. Mark Meadows was involved in some communications with people who were part of the insurrection. And so Mark Meadows, A, clearly is on the hook for obstructing this investigation, but B, is a clear player in a conspiracy and whatever you want to charge, whether it's obstruction or whether it's sedition or what have you. Mark Meadows is significantly exposed in such an investigation. And that's why DOJ is taking their time is to put together a charge like that, such that you might be able to flip Meadows.
He also has a problem with voter fraud in North Carolina, he and his wife. So there's, it sounds like there's a whole stack of potential charges against Mark Meadows and maybe.
Right. Whereas particularly with Navarro, I've always said from the start that it's not clear to me that Navarro broke the law. Navarro, on paper at least, claims that he only wanted Congress to make objections. I think Navarro may be insulated from the direct ties to the insurrectionists that both Roger Stone and Rudy Giuliani and probably Mike Flynn and, you know, probably Steve Bannon, they all likely have ties to people who were orchestrating the insurrection. Navarro probably doesn't.
Right.
So Navarro's not tied to the attack on the Capitol directly. He's tied to the efforts to stall the congressional vote. Navarro at least claims he didn't want the violence. So he's not got as much legal exposure as Stone.
Right. January 6th. But he went on MSNBC and basically admitted to his role. Here's a clip that's going around.
We had over 100 congressmen and senators on Capitol Hill ready to implement the sweep. We were going to challenge the results of the election in the six battleground states.
Do you realize you are describing a coup?
No.
Why risk a legal battle or going to jail to refuse to discuss them with the committee under oath.
The president has invoked executive privilege. It's not my privilege to waive.
Do you understand that you've already waived it by discussing it? They want under oath. And number two, finally, Peter. Finally, Peter.
No.
Are you prepared to risk indictment for defying the subpoena?
I'll stand tall on this.
So he went on TV. Basically, it sounded like to me he's bragging about his role in the coup attempt.
Except that he's always talking about Congress.
Uh-huh.
And well, getting Congress to challenge the vote certifications from each state was a key part of the conspiracy. We'll call it conspiracy. Mm-hmm. To the extent that he is only talking about congressional challenges, that's not a crime. Having right. Congress right. challenge the vote is not a no. crime. It's a crime to force Peter. It's a crime to try and coerce Mike Pence to commit a crime, which is where John Eastman, I think, has significantly more criminal exposure. It's a crime to sic a mob out to assassinate mm-hmm. Mike Pence, which is where Trump and maybe Stone, maybe Giuliani have significantly more exposure. What Navarro claims to have done, and I haven't seen the paperwork, is far more modest and not clearly illegal.
Gotcha.
And so even in that clip with Melber, right, he's describing that Trump invoked executive privilege. Well, he didn't. I mean, this is what we know from the Bannon case is mm-hmm. Trump's lawyer basically waved a hand and said executive privilege without doing the things you need to do to waive executive privilege without actually working with Congress themselves. I assume the record is the same with Navarro, and I assume DOJ knows that, having, you know, spent 6 months looking through the record on Bannon. And I assume one thing they're going to get from the subpoena, if Navarro complies, is a pattern by which Trump is claiming executive privilege without actually invoking it as a way to try and obstruct these investigations. And I think that that's leverage to get Navarro to start talking. Oh. So my guess is, you know, they're going to take a unique approach to all of these people. With Bannon, they charged him. With Navarro, who was a close presidential associate. And so the right. executive privilege claims are slightly different. Maybe they'll try and flip him, because I don't think he's as legally exposed as Meadows, certainly, and Bannon probably. And then with Meadows, you work on that charge. You work on significant legal charges such that he's going to want to start talking.
Right. Wow. So, Marcy Wheeler, chances are we're not going to talk before the hearings, before the televised hearings next week. I'm hoping we can talk afterwards and sort of do a wrap up of what happened. But what do you expect the outcome to be? What do you expect us to be thinking when the hearings are over and we're done?
Look, it's you and I, and we're going to be really impressed, right? Right. Especially you, who hasn't been living and breathing this January 6th stuff for right. a year and a half.
Exactly.
And I think people who haven't been living and breathing the January 6th stuff for a year and a half will be impressed. I think that Fox News will be covering Hunter Biden's laptop. Margaret Sullivan, the Washington Post columnist, did a piece saying, this is not going to work the way it did in Watergate, because there's not unified media.
Right.
I mean, Fox is not going to cover, like yesterday after the Sussman verdict, before it, Fox was basically saying, well, gosh, if Sussman is acquitted, that's sort of a black eye for Durham. After Sussman was acquitted, they were like, the headlines on Fox were ridiculous, Nicole. They were like, the person accused of lying to the FBI learned his fate. They didn't say Durham had an embarrassing failure. They didn't say he was acquitted. They wow. didn't tell you the results of the trial, because they are shielding their viewers from that actual news. And so you should expect similar backflips about what actually happened when the January 6th committee starts presenting their evidence. You're going to find similar kinds of things we saw in both impeachment trials, with the right wing all speaking from the same talking points.
Yep.
So I don't expect that to be much different. I'm sorry. I expect it to be slightly more effective. It'll be effective because Liz Cheney will be involved. And frankly, because Liz Cheney is a more effective bureaucrat and a more fearless bureaucrat than most of the Democrats.
True.
I mean,
you know, I agree. Yep.
She's learned the evil ways of her father and hopefully put them to good use.
Yeah.
And we should expect, you know, people in the middle to be impressed. But we should not expect this to be Watergate. And I'm sorry to say that. We're just not that country anymore.
No, I hear you. Well, sad, but true. Marcy Wheeler, I can't thank you enough for living and breathing this for the last year and a half to help us understand it along the way. I look forward to talking with you when the hearings are done and seeing what we learned and what still is to be done. Marcy, thank you so very much.
Take care.
Marcy Wheeler, she is the woman, the woe man. Find her at emptywheel.net, on Twitter at emptywheel. Again, we taped that conversation a week ago tomorrow. So at the end, when we were talking about Peter Navarro, he hadn't yet been arrested. He hadn't been shackled and not been allowed to call his lawyer and not been allowed to answer any questions. Yeah. Poor Peter Navarro. Wah, wah, wah. All right. So there you go. Okay. We are 2 days away from the start of the hearings. Now, we don't know the exact schedule. We do know that they will begin Thursday evening at 8 p.m. Eastern. And then there will be another hearing on, is it either, oh, hold on, I'll tell you, hold on. Monday the 13th at 10 a.m., and that's all they have set in stone. Earlier, they did lay out a handful of other dates, but now they're no longer on the schedule. So we're going to take it a day at a time. We're going to cover these things as they happen. Obviously, I'm not on the air Thursday night, but Friday's show is blocked out to just deal with whatever happens Thursday evening. Okay. All right. So there you go. Tomorrow, I'm not sure what we'll do, but we will further prepare for the festivities, for the event of the week, year, millennium, Thursday night. So we'll do that tomorrow. Thanks for listening, everyone. As usual, I'll leave you with the news. And for the people in the chat room who asked, while the news is playing, I'm going to show, if you're watching on video, a few of my newest artistic creations. So we'll do that. All right. Here's the news. I'll see you tomorrow. Thank you for listening, everyone. And thanks for all the super chat donations in the YouTube chat room. Appreciate it more than you know. Bye.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
As we inch ever closer to the public hearing portion of the House Select Committee's investigation into the events surrounding January 6th, more proverbial shoes keep dropping. The latest? The Justice Department on Monday charged the head of the Proud Boys, Enrique Terrio, and four others with seditious conspiracy stemming from their involvement in the January 6th attack on the Capitol. They are the first allegations by prosecutors that the Proud Boys tried to oppose by force the presidential transfer of power. While we're waiting, it's time to vote. Well, if you're in one of the seven states whose primary is today, those are California, Iowa, Mississippi, Montana, New Jersey, New Mexico, and South Dakota. Of course, the big ticket is California. Few big races to watch, like the Los Angeles mayoral election. Although there are lots of names on the ballot, it's really coming down to a choice between two. Karen Bass, one-time chair of the Congressional Black Caucus and an incumbent congressperson representing the Culver City area of Los Angeles. She is still the front runner in the race, but coming up quickly is billionaire Rick Caruso, who until this campaign was a Republican, who's already dumped more than $34 million of his own money into the campaign and will likely keep Karen Bass to under 50%, which would force them into a runoff in November. Other big races under the spotlight, California's 40th district open primary to see if an even further right Trumper can defeat the incumbent in a primary. Democrats figuring they have an easier time to beat the challenger Greg Raths than the incumbent Young Kim, but who knows? And then in California's 27th, it's another open primary in a district that Biden won by more than 10 points, But the incumbent, Garcia, has already beaten candidate Christy Smith twice. In Montana, former Congressman Ryan Zinke, who left the House in 2017 to become Trump's scandal-plagued Interior Secretary, is running to go back to Congress, and a few other races are under scrutiny today. Meanwhile, two losing Democratic primary candidates in key Texas swing districts have said they will ask for recounts in their very close runoffs. Progressive Jessica Cisneros lost to conservadem Henry Cuellar by 281 votes. Texas law does not provide any automatic recounts, but if a candidate is behind by less than 10%, can request and pay for their own. So Jessica Cisneros will have a recount, as will moderate Ruben Ramirez, who lost to progressive Michelle Vallejo by 30 votes. Here in Florida, I can't say this was unexpected, State Senator Annette Tedeo has announced she's dropping out of the governor's race, but is switching over to challenge Congresswoman Maria Elvira Salazar in Florida's 27th congressional district. Good. We need her there. That leaves two Democrats vying for the Democratic nomination in the governor's race to run against Ron DeSantis. Ugh. So there's a small bipartisan group of senators who've been working, trying to come up with a framework on a deal to do something about our nation's gun problem, mass shooting problem. But everyone involved is warning, don't expect any sweeping changes to the gun laws. Senator John Cornyn of Texas is leading the negotiations for the Republicans, and he said there will not be sweeping changes to gun laws. Law-abiding citizens' ability to purchase weapons will not be curtailed. The size of gun magazines will not be limited. The age of assault weapons won't be raised. Cornyn stressed that any proposal on guns would focus on incremental changes. Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut, home of Newtown, is leading the negotiations for the Democrats. And he says they're talking about a modest package of proposals encompassing mental health resources, school safety mechanisms, enhanced background checks, and state incentives for red flag laws. I can't help myself. Not good enough. Just saying. Meanwhile, police in Philadelphia have arrested a 34-year-old man in connection with a mass shooting that left three people dead and 11 wounded on Saturday night in the city's South Street district. The man, whose name I will not say, has been charged with attempted murder, aggravated assault, simple assault, recklessly endangering another person, and other charges. An 18-year-old was previously arrested and charged with aggravated assault and assault on law enforcement officers. That suspect was taken to the hospital on the night of the shooting after a police officer shot him in the hand. The incident reportedly grew out of an altercation that involved these two men, one of them and a friend on one side, the other and another man on the other. Can you imagine if they didn't have guns? They'd have to rely on their fists for aggression. Probably a better idea. An Arizona judge declined a request by the state Republican Party to block most mail-in ballots for the 2022 election, preserving the voting method used by the overwhelming majority of voters. Arizona is among the states with the highest levels of mail-in voting, a system that's grown overwhelmingly popular with voters from both parties and independents. Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador on Monday decided he would boycott this week's Summit of the Americas meetings in Los Angeles, and it surprised many in the Biden administration who didn't think he'd actually make good on those threats. Meanwhile, a new migrant caravan is reportedly headed for the U.S. from southern Mexico. The several thousand migrants may constitute one of the largest such caravans in recent years. Well, across the pond, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson survived a no-confidence vote on Monday, securing enough support from his Conservative Party to remain in office, but just. The vote, 211 in favor and 148 against, fell short of the simple majority of Conservative lawmakers needed to oust Johnson, who has come under fire for hosting a series of parties and breaking protocols during the 2020-2021 COVID-19 lockdowns. The win insulates Johnson from another vote for 12 months under current rules, but those rules could change. This vote was triggered after 15% or 54 of the Conservative Party's 359 members, submitted a letter of no confidence. Votes of no confidence allow for the removal of a prime minister deemed unfit to serve. Johnson's future is at best tenuous. But people in the UK might be a little happier. Thousands of UK workers will receive 100% of their pay for working just 4 days a week. It's the largest trial of its kind in the world, a pilot program that'll last for 6 months and involve 3,300 employees from 70 companies, ranging from financial services providers to a fish and chip restaurant. The program is being run by a think tank in partnership with researchers from Cambridge, Oxford, and Boston College. 4 day work week? I could get behind that. And that's just a bit of what's news for now. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider making a contribution. My work is 100% listener supported, and I can't do it without your help. Find out more at NicoleSandler.com, and please click on that donate button.